Hello, everybody. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. Today, I'm interviewing one of the relatively few female CEOs leading a what is de facto a faith-based international NGO here in the US. The name of the organization is Medical Teams International, and my guest today is Martha Holly Newsom. And Martha's career path has been that of somebody who, starting from a grassroots operations job in local community health, worked her way all the way up to the CEO of Medical Teams International. And actually, Martha, I suddenly realized that I interviewed one of your predecessors years and years ago. That suddenly came up for me. In this podcast, I want to dive into some assumptions and myths when it comes to faith-based NGOs, especially amongst those of us who happen to work in secular organizations. I would like to explore those assumptions a little bit with Martha and together come to a more nuanced understanding on faith-based NGOs in this episode. My own experience with faith-based organizations extends to having collaborated with colleagues in World Vision, Church World Service, Catholic Relief Service, Islamic Relief, and most recently, I have started to work with a large Christian faith-based NGO in my consulting capacity. Myself, I'm a Catholic by upbringing and now a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church here in the US. And Martha and I coincidentally met several times at an Interaction CEO retreat and a Women's CEO retreat. Interaction is the umbrella organization for NGOs here in the US. So Martha, with that long intro, welcome.
Thank you, Tosca. And I'm just delighted to join you on this podcast. In fact, the name of it just intrigues me. The fact that it's about NGO soul and strategy. That had me hooked from the very beginning.
Oh, that's lovely to know. Well, soul, what I meant it to convey is not so much the spiritual soul of NGOs, although that can definitely be an important asset. What I meant is I have a particular preoccupation with organizational culture and identity and DNA of NGOs as organization. And the soul, to me, is also related to that. So
true. It has so many meanings, right?
So many meanings. But I love that you were attracted to that. I like it too. So Martha, let's start. No, actually, first I have to tell our audience a little bit about you. So you're the president and CEO of Medical Teams International, which is based in Portland, Oregon, here in the US. Is that right?
That's right.
It's still the case. Yes. You worked for 19 years at World Vision, where you were a vice president, a senior director, the head of the Africa region's HIV/AIDS division, a national director, and more, number of capacities in World Vision before you came to Medical Teams International. And you have a degree in public health from Johns Hopkins University. So, Martha, for those who do not know Medical Teams International, what is your mission all about, and what makes you stand out from other NGOs who, I imagine, deliver a medical services? What is your organization's unique added value?
Thanks, Tosca. So Medical Teams International, we, as you already mentioned, were headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and we were started in 1979 by a Salem businessman, responding to the plight of the Cambodian refugees. So we are a Christian health and humanitarian organization. And in fact, when I started with the organization in 2016, we sort of went back to what do we do best and really focus the strategy even more on the health and humanitarian space, because we're a small or medium-sized nonprofit. And so we really wanted to bring our best to the world of humanitarian response. And that means providing basic, as we like to say, life-saving medical care. So we do primary care and run health facilities. And we also seek to strengthen and work alongside the Ministry of Health and the medical actors in any particular context and work with the community. So strengthening, you know, those who have been impacted either by natural disasters or from man-made crises. And of course, we're seeing more of the latter In terms of the complexity of the conflicts that we're responding to, whether it's the civil war in Ethiopia or the war in Ukraine, where we're responding today. So we are active in 7 countries and then the US as well. So 8 total is where we're working at the moment.
Got it. But it's always in a crisis, whether man-made or nature-made. So it's most often shorter-term relief of a medical nature.
That's a great question. So actually, because one of the myths, you said you like to explore myths. One of the myths is that refugees are in a country in a short-term basis, which is not true.
They're not.
I mean, the average amount of time that they spend is anywhere from 12 to 20 years. So in fact, we do have long-term programs, but the long-term programs that we run are with the refugee or displaced population. So our biggest program, for example, is in Uganda, where we are providing health services, again, in partnership with the Ministry of Health for 1.3 million people. So about 65 different clinics, and that includes the refugees as well as the surrounding community. So there's some long-term programs with refugees in Tanzania, in Uganda. We're responding to the Venezuelans that have fled into Colombia, also the Ethiopians that have fled into Sudan. So running programs in Sudan and Ethiopia, and then in Moldova and Ukraine.
Got it. Now you mentioned, and this was something that was immediately of interest to me when I researched medical teams, is that you have a U.S. domestic program as well. Why did you start that? And what does it do for you? By which I mean, as an organization, from a reputational perspective here in the U.S. with domestic constituencies, I could imagine it could be meaningful for them in terms of deepening local ownership. What does it do for you from a fundraising perspective? Why did you do it?
Great question. And in fact, the domestic side of our program has existed for 33 years. So this decision far preceded my arrival to medical teams. And initially, the thought was, you know, we are in the business of helping people access care when they're in a very critical point where they really have no access. And of course, that applies to our neighbors in the U.S. So there are many populations in the U.S. that for various reasons don't have access to care. So initially, I think they started in medical with a medical van, and then it switched for a long time to exclusively dental. So our big recreational vehicles, you know, with medical teams on the side, we're providing mobile dental services.
Right.
That's because many people in the U.S. had no access to dental care.
Absolutely.
And that is obviously a significant impact for their health. I mean, we tend to disassociate dental from health, but it is intricately related.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally. And I have to tell for a moment, Martha, spontaneously, as a European who's lived in the U.S. now 20 years, and I live in upstate New York, in the rural part of upstate New York, especially in my first 5 to 10 years, I was struck by how many people who are low income clearly have not had dental care for a long time. So
I think
it's wonderful now that you focus on dental care. So, but do you feel, I'm curious, do you feel that having a domestic program of a significant size, not an add-on, if you will, is that helping you with the local, having local roots here in the U.S., not just from a donor perspective, but more broadly, local ownership?
Yes. And let me back up just a teeny bit to say what has changed from it being mobile dental for a long time. But then that will help me get to answering that question specifically, which is when we switched our strategy in May of 2017 and really decided to focus on the humanitarian context overseas, we also made a strategic decision to align our U.S. program more systematically with what we were doing overseas. So we started to think about, if we're getting to people who don't have access to dental care, what else do they need? How else could we participate in the social safety net in terms of helping them to connect to other sources of care? Because many of them have multiple needs, whether it's housing or whether they don't actually also have access to health, whether they're suffering from the impact of mental health and addictions and need access to those services. So we started to think about how our program could become a more complete package of services and be part of the social safety net in the US. Mm. And so we said we wanted to pilot what we were starting to call Care and Connect. How can we provide that immediate, urgent care that they need and connect them into long-term care, whatever that might be? And then COVID hit. And so with COVID, we hadn't even had a chance to pilot this idea of Care and Connect, but immediately the health departments in Oregon and Washington reached out to us because we had these mobile vehicles and a way to get out to populations that didn't have access, whether they didn't speak English, BIPOC communities, elderly, veterans, houseless. You know, these were all people that urgently needed COVID services. So in the midst of responding to COVID, we grew exponentially and really started to partner very closely with our departments of health in these two states and major health systems. And so that has helped us to literally triple the size of our program in the last 2.5 years, starting with COVID vaccination, well, starting with COVID testing, and then moving into vaccinations, and then coming full circle with a Biden administration innovation grant to add the dental care back in, which was exactly what we wanted to do in the first place, you know, move towards a Care and Connect model. So that's where we stand today. And back to your question, we do love the fact that this allows us to talk about the needs of Americans and how urgent care for us is incredibly important, and that we want to serve our neighbors, whether they're here in the States and don't access care, or whether they're refugees and displaced overseas and have no access to care. So it provides a consistent message for us and a local base.
Local to global, also living out basically what local to global means. And
That's right.
The issues of poverty and discrimination and injustice, et cetera, are just as much here relevant here in the US as they are elsewhere, which I increasingly is an incredibly important message to act on. Now, switching to you as an individual leader, tell us a little bit about moments from your childhood that shaped you to be the person you are today. Before we started recording, you told me a snippet of a remarkable story. Do you want to go back there?
Sure. Thanks, Tesca. I think what a key motivational story for me is really the impact that my dad had on my life. And so he was a medical doctor. I was an army brat who remarkably hated moving and then have spent the rest of my life moving around the world. But the reason that he had such an impact on me is that he, first of all, loved his patients. So he loved medicine. So I grew up, you know, spending a lot of time in hospitals. He was an obstetrician and gynecologist and didn't want to be a pediatrician because he hated, he was just so moved by the sick children. So he wanted to be on the happy end of helping kids, you know, come into being.
Into life. Yeah,
that's right. So surrounded by those medical sort of roots, I then had an opportunity when I was 12, I was running with my dad, and really tragically, he had a sudden heart attack and passed away.
I see.
Immediately. Yeah. So that, as you can imagine, as a young teenager, obviously shook my world to its core. And I was a pretty happy-go-lucky kid up to that point. But I think after, you know, experiencing that, I really wanted to lean into his legacy and decided that I would follow in his footsteps and become a doctor. And because of my church community, I thought, well, I want to be a missionary doctor because the people overseas, even though I had never traveled overseas, I thought they really need care even more than Americans do. So headed out with that intention and then got to college and into the pre-med program and kind of had my second sort of most pivotal moment, which got me into public health. And that was really starting to most pre-med students get to organic chemistry, and what they don't tell you is that 50% of the students drop out at that point, right?
So yes, my kids have experience with that.
So you know that from a personal perspective. So got to organic, I was playing field hockey, involved in a tutoring program in Southside Chicago, working, and just got so overloaded and thought, why am I doing this? I'm going to have so much debt. I'm not going to be able to go overseas until I'm 35. So I had a real crisis as only a, 20 something year old can have a crisis that was going to end my life, of course, and decided to give it all up. And then ran into some students that were part of a program called Human Needs and Global Resources at Wheaton College. And they told me that they were headed to Cameroon to do public health. And I was like, public health? I had never even heard of public health. So signed up immediately and was able to join that program and really study anthropology. It was kind of like a minor program. And then that sent me to Cameroon for 6 months to work with there were some Baptist missionaries that were running a community healthcare program in very, very remote villages. And that allowed me to live in those remote villages and work with community health workers for 6 months. And that experience cemented my love for public health.
And for community health.
Yes.
Got it.
That's right.
Now, we all have experienced failures in our lives. And some of the mistakes that actually help us shape in useful ways, right? Tell me about one or two of those that you think made you the leader that you are today.
Oh, there's all of us have a long litany of failures, right? But which ones are most instructive? I think for me, I probably experienced the most leadership failures in my biggest stint as a new leader when I moved from being the health director in Mozambique. So I was the health director for World Vision Mozambique. And then they asked me to take on the country director role. And I really had very little training. So 33-year-old public health person being asked to take on a big country director role for a large program. Mm. It's about 28 million, 900 staff, 5 provinces. So it was like jumping into the deep end. So nothing like a primer to learn your leadership skills really fast. And I think one of the first things I realized is that I had all these ideas of how this program should change because it had really emerged out of responding to the civil war in Mozambique. And so now the transition had happened and Mozambique was, reestablishing itself as a young democracy. So of course the program needed to change and modify. So I think I embarked on all that change really on my own and didn't understand, a lot of the general concepts about organizational change that,
which I love.
Yes, of course, as an organizational change person, right? You need leaders, cadres leading change. You need that guiding coalition. So I think at first I just thought I was just going to barrel into this program of change without really bringing people with me. And so I think I learned a very powerful lesson that you cannot affect that change as a leader alone. You need to bring people with you. You need to take time to build the reason why you're changing. And I think having had that experience in Mozambique, when I came to medical teams and we really embarked on significant change in terms of refocusing the organization on the humanitarian context, that allowed me to do it in a better way the second time around.
Oh, this makes me think, Martha, that I should interview you on a separate occasion about that case study.
Sure.
Talk about that case study in change management and what you think you did right, what you think you did wrong, and what you learned. But that's for another day.
Sure.
So let's move to the topic of faith-based organizations, right? In my view, they have huge assets in the form of staff and board members, volunteers, etc. Often have a deep well of motivation, right?
That's right.
And also, as we know, many people around the world are deeply spiritual. If they're not explicitly religious, they are definitely spiritual.
Absolutely.
And not all of them, obviously, Christian by far, but many, many people are deeply spiritual. And yet it seems that secular NGOs and also the kind of development discipline seems to often assume that that is not the case, and that we look at the world purely from a secular perspective, which then doesn't always work, right, in our
program
intentions, etc., in short. On top of that, faith-based organizations have potentially a deep well of trust in local communities through the churches, the mosques, the temples, etc., right?
That's right.
So I'm curious, to what extent does medical teams benefit from the natural bonding and trust that can exist between different people of the same faith? Do these assets that I just listed, do they play out for medical teams or not so much?
Yes, they do. And maybe let me perhaps explain a little bit about medical teams.
Please do. You told me something interesting.
That's right. And how we show up as a faith-based organization is a little different than some others. And so people might have assumptions about what that means.
Yeah, please go there.
So for us, I mean, one of the operating principles is that our faith motivates us. So we are actually registered as a regular 501c3 in the US and not as a explicit faith-based nonprofit. And that has been the case for medical teams since its inception, which is interesting, but it has always been motivated by faith. And so we say that it's part of our culture and it's what inspires and motivates us. And so the calling, which we say our vision is our calling, and it's daring to love like Jesus, we boldly break barriers to health and restore wholeness in a hurting world. So that is an incredible galvanizing force for us. And we ask our staff that join medical teams how they align with that. So they don't have to, you know, necessarily ascribe to a certain denomination or have a faith statement, but what does that mean to them? How does that motivate them? And then it also shows up in our values of being courageous and tenacious, accountable, selfless, and not alone. And we say God is with us, you know, and this, and the work that we do is really hard. And so I think some of the, what you were talking about in terms of the trust and the motivation is really, it does bond us together in a sense, right? It gives us that added inspiration when things are really tough and when you're working in really difficult circumstances. So that allows us to kind of own this middle space. And so we say that we want to attract people to join us and be part of us, whether they're staff or volunteers, or the, you know, the community volunteers that we work with, the community health volunteers that we work with overseas, because we want to be the hands and feet of Jesus and aspire to show up that way. So I love the fact that we want to lead by example, but invite, be a big tent in terms of who can join us and be part of us, whether they're from a Muslim faith or whether they're from a Christian faith, or whether they don't actually have a sense of personal faith, but they're attracted to our calling statement and our values because of who we are and how we're trying to show up.
I see. Let me probe a little bit on one point. You said that your staff are not selected or hired based on ascribing to one same church or even official religion, right?
Right.
Is that true all the way to the top? So is it also true that there is not a selection criteria at the higher levels of leadership? Because I know for a fact that that is true with certain other faith-based organizations, that once you are, let's say, a national director and up, as an example, right, you need to be of the same faith. How is that in medical teams?
I would say we ask the same questions about our calling statement and values to everybody at all levels. Where it is different is with our board. And that's because our board of directors are volunteers. And so historically, we have had a faith statement that the board of directors has signed. In fact, we just recently changed that to the Nicene Creed, again, because we wanted it to be broader. So you're from a Catholic background, and not now, but originally. And so the Nicene Creed for the Catholics on our board was more well understood and acceptable language. And whereas our old statement probably had more of a Protestant sounding roots to it. And so where it gets more explicit is at the board level. And that's, again, to retain the culture of the organization and also to, follow the legal requirements of a 501c3. So that allows us to exist in that space and follow those legal.
Got it. Interesting. Thank you for providing that nuance. We already talked about some of the obvious strengths that faith-based organizations have that, in my view, secular organizations sometimes, quote unquote, would die for, right? Have reason to covet. What potential weaknesses or blind spots do you see show up in medical teams or in peer organizations that you think have some link to being faith-based in whatever way each organization is differently faith-based?
Yes. I think one of the downsides oftentimes when you have people that are very passionate and motivated by their faith is I think there can be an isolation in that vision and mission is enough, right? And so there can be a naivete, perhaps, as you get into this work, especially of not connecting with others, not understanding the humanitarian community, the professional standards that are required, to work in this space, and that we really owe the people that we serve.
Yeah.
And that we're coming alongside them, but we want to bring the best of what we have to offer. And so that means connecting into that humanitarian community. So you sometimes see younger or smaller faith-based organizations kind of barreling in as if they are completely able to manage this context on their own, right? And I think that can be a real weakness. They may not show up to be part of the humanitarian cluster. And so we are always encouraging smaller Christian organizations to coordinate to be part of the broader secular and faith-based community of practice, so to speak, and to coordinate and learn together. So we're part of a group called the Integral Alliance, which is 21 Christian development and humanitarian organizations that do just that. They try and partner together, and many of them are smaller. And so by being part of this alliance, we have made a choice to respond to disasters together. And with that, that has allowed us to help some of these smaller Christian nonprofits to understand, hey, we believe that the core humanitarian standards are absolutely essential and now have adopted those and are as an alliance ascribing to those standards. Another weakness can be sometimes in a humanitarian response, if your only partner is the church. That's not true of medical teams because we see our partner as the Ministry of Health and the humanitarian partners that we work alongside. But we have seen some Christian nonprofits that work through the church. If you bring that to a humanitarian response, that can be a little tricky in the speed of that response. Those partners may not understand the core humanitarian principles, for example, and how to avoid proselytism. And so there's a need to really help your partners to understand all of those principles that are so important, that we do not offer any aid that is tied to any belief or any participation in a religious activity that is proselytism. So some of those key principles
need
to be reinforced.
That sounds marvelous to me. I'm really happy to hear you unpack in such a nuanced, thoughtful ways, what are both the strengths and the weaknesses. I totally resonate with everything you just said. Now, one particular aspect that actually your team suggested we also address in this podcast, and I'm definitely interested in that angle too, is about what's it like to be a woman top leader in a faith-based organization like medical teams. Anecdotally, I'm saying that really underlined, anecdotally, it seems that women are underrepresented in Christian faith-based organizations in, let's say, the top two levels of leadership. I haven't done the research on this, but that's my sense. Would you comment on that? Do you think there is some truth in that or not? And how does it play out for you as a top leader?
Great question, Tesca. And I think your assumption is, from what we have seen in the US space, the Christian humanitarian or the Christian development nonprofits are behind the secular nonprofits in the US. And so we talked earlier about how we met through interaction. And,
yes.
And I think those, I heard the story, and you probably have too, at one point Interaction had predominantly male CEOs. And then over time that has changed really dramatically, right? It's almost 50-50 right now, as far as I know.
Oh yeah.
And in the Christian nonprofit space, it is not 50%, not in the US. Now, that Integral Alliance that I talked about, when I started, I think there was one or two couple women CEOs, and we've seen bit by bit it changing, but it's slower, and it's slower in the US as well. And I wonder if that is because of the teaching in the church. And so many churches in the US are grappling in terms of their understanding of what does the Bible say about women in leadership. And I think that unconsciously may impact the culture of these Christian nonprofits. They would say, no, you know, women have equal opportunity in our nonprofit. But I think that perhaps some of their own personal beliefs may provide some of that unconscious bias that may hold women back a bit from rising in the ranks. And in fact, a brief little story of an aspiring young woman that I know is—I tell her all the time she's going to be the next president of the United States. So she is, you know, top notch, and she was a fellow in a Christian university, and then was asked to be mentored by the president. But then she found that the president was uncomfortable with having her travel with him, but her male counterpart, there was no discomfort there. So just small ways that Christian women may have a disadvantage that's not even explicit, really, although she saw it as explicit and did something about it as a young advocate. So, but I think those are the kinds of barriers that Christian women may experience in their careers that can make it a little difficult to crash into the upper levels of leadership in some organizations, not all,
definitely not, but it is somewhat noticeable, as you said. So you've already talked deep about these kind of archetypes or belief systems about women and positional power, right? And there are others that secular organizations may well also struggle with, but
sure.
It sounds like you do think that the archetypes about women and positional power and organizational leadership, et cetera, are somewhat different from those of secular NGOs. Is that the case?
Yes, I think so. Because if on Sundays you worship at a church where women are not allowed to be elders or pastors or preachers, I think that subtly influences you. So you use the word archetype. So maybe that starts to bring some of the internal conflict, right? That, well, why in this house of worship are women not allowed to be leaders, but now they can be leaders in a Christian nonprofit? That creates some dissonance, right? In terms of those beliefs, perhaps making it a little bit harder to see women as legitimate leaders in a different context. So if you don't see them as leaders in one context, how do you then flip the switch to say, oh, but they can be leaders in every other part of society? I think that creates some internal conflict for people, certainly for me. And I'm part of a book club of women who have been studying these issues and reading books and going back to like even what the original text in the Bible said, and how some of that bias might even be implicit in the way things, the ways that words have been translated.
Oh, yeah.
Over the centuries.
Goes back, you make me think, Martha, of my time during my when I was studying my master's degree and my interest in feminist theology from a Catholic perspective at that time. It's the same thing, right? These things go very deep. But at the same time, I hear you say they are shifting. And it sounds like the Integral Alliance is, as part of a probably much bigger mission, but is aware of this as an issue and is trying to make a difference in that regard?
To some extent, although each organization has its own board and comes from countries around the world, it's international, right? So we have the whole Tier Fund group that represents, you know, from Tier Fund New Zealand to Tier Fund Canada. So to some degree, having these conversations with respect to diversity, equity, and inclusion, especially the inclusion piece, right, in terms of inequity for both men and women. And so it's part of those conversations, but each organization, I think, has to go on a journey, on its own journey, right, if you're going to have a CEO that rises up and is asked by the board, you know, to invited by the board to come on as CEO. And so for me, there was a very influential woman that was part of the board of medical teams that played that role of opening up the conversation to say, oh, when they started meeting with the recruiter to say, oh, well, she might be this, this, and this. And it could be a woman that would be the right candidate. And very skillfully and influentially, a leader herself created space within the board for that to be discussed and for them ultimately to say, hey, we want you, Martha, will you come on as president and CEO? So you see that each institution has to go on its own journey. So while the Integral Alliance can talk about it, we don't have much contact with the board. And the board is the ones that recruit the CEO. So I see that change needing to happen within board of directors.
I see.
Ultimately.
And we know, of course, that there are also huge differences within each institutionalized religion, right?
That's right.
Geographically, et cetera, across the world in social values around women and around LGBT people, et cetera, et cetera. So it's no religious institution is a homogeneous body in that regard.
That's right.
I need to ask you one more thing before we need to bring this to a close, and that is shifting topic again, and that is about medical teams messaging. I was struck when I looked at your website, you emphasize words like loving the vulnerable, healing suffering, healing the broken, saving, this idea of saving people. Right. And I come across that and also in some secular organizations for sure. But I come across that more, it seems, even in, amongst faith-based organizations. And as you know, because I know you're very well tapped into the current kind of discussions in the NGO sector, that in some part of our community, there's a lot of discussion and self-interrogation on decolonizing aid, shifting power, anti-racism, diversity, equity, and inclusion. From that perspective, do you think that the language that medical teams uses, is there anything that makes you as a top leader wonder whether that language needs to undergo some change of its own or not necessarily?
Yeah. Are you comfortable? Very astute. I'm glad that you have been perusing our website and asking those questions, because you're right, Tuska. This this conversation, we're on a journey as an organization in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and decolonization of aid, like many of our peer organizations. Mm-hmm. So we really have been digging into the diversity, equity, inclusion space more, especially with everything that happened in the US around George Floyd, and really thinking about it from a US context first. But this year we have prioritized really digging into the decolonization of aid and doing some more learning there. So I would say we have moved away, and maybe we need to do another scrub of our website with saying that people are vulnerable. So you're right. If that's still showing up, we want to make that change, because they are survivors. They're not victims. They're heroes in their own right in terms of their ability to survive and thrive in incredibly difficult circumstances. So we are working to shift that. And there may be some vestiges that still need to change. I think the saving piece is interesting, because we have used that word very explicitly to help non-medical people understand that the care that we are offering is truly life-saving.
Life-saving.
We always say it's life-saving. And so I'm a little distressed to think that, you know, folks would think, oh, it's this, we're saving the world. No, that we, and that white savior complex, we do not want that to be misunderstood, but we've been trying to kind of take medical language and make it very accessible to say that the care that we provide is truly life-saving. So a story, in Tigray, you know, as the embargo, Tigray has been embargoed until very recently for a year and a half. Our Tigrayan staff, 90% of our staff are nationals in the context where we work. And they have continued to provide mobile medical services in Tigray with almost nothing. The only thing we could bring in was cash. And so these mobile medical teams ended up delivering babies. They're not supposed to deliver babies. The reason they delivered babies was truly life-saving. Those women would have died. Yeah. So that's what we mean by life-saving. Yeah. Recently, they weren't even able to get fuel. Cars were not allowed to get out because the embargo still is not fully lifted. They hired donkeys and donkey carts to get out to provide life-saving care. So we want that idea of life-saving to mean, hey, we're there in the most critical moment. We want to be there with people when they truly don't have access to medical care and step into that gap, but then eventually hand over to the Ministry of Health and leave. You know, our dream is to exit, you know, to be there with people in crisis, serving with nationals who speak their language, who have incredible skills and experience, and then, you know, eventually be able to hand over and exit, having really reestablished those facilities and allowing the Ministry of Health to continue to provide those services.
I'm so glad I asked you the question, and that makes a lot of sense.
That's right.
So I'm glad we dug in there a little bit. Well, we have to bring this to a close, Martha. So
sad.
This was very, very interesting to me. Where can people go if they want to learn more about you as a person, as a leader, and medical teams as an organization?
Well, Chris, they can go to our Medical Teams International website, which is medicalteams.com. And then I am very active on LinkedIn, so they can just look up Martha Holley, H-O-L-L-E-Y Newsome, and find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter. I'm trying to remember my handle.
We can put that in the show notes. Don't worry.
Thank you. If you help me with that. All the platforms, people can easily find me on
good. And Twitter, you also Instagram. Mentioned in addition, before we started recording, that there was a 30-minute radio story produced about your life, right?
And that's right. Our American Stories. And we will provide that link for your listeners.
Would. Yeah, yes. I would love to include that in the show notes, because based on what you told me just in that small snippet, that probably is very worthy of listening by myself and anybody else who wants to. Thank you very much, Martha, for all your insights. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast stimulating, then be sure to check out other episodes of my podcast. There is, for instance, episode 25 that celebrates the presence of three women leaders, three Latina women at the helm of major NGOs. And you can find that episode and others, not just on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, but also on my YouTube channel. Subscribe to my email list and you'll be the first to know next time when I interview super interesting people like Martha. This is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time on NGO Soul and Strategy. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over three decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, everybody. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. Today, I'm interviewing one of the relatively few female CEOs leading a what is de facto a faith-based international NGO here in the US. The name of the organization is Medical Teams International, and my guest today is Martha Holly Newsom. And Martha's career path has been that of somebody who, starting from a grassroots operations job in local community health, worked her way all the way up to the CEO of Medical Teams International. And actually, Martha, I suddenly realized that I interviewed one of your predecessors years and years ago. That suddenly came up for me. In this podcast, I want to dive into some assumptions and myths when it comes to faith-based NGOs, especially amongst those of us who happen to work in secular organizations. I would like to explore those assumptions a little bit with Martha and together come to a more nuanced understanding on faith-based NGOs in this episode. My own experience with faith-based organizations extends to having collaborated with colleagues in World Vision, Church World Service, Catholic Relief Service, Islamic Relief. And most recently, I have started to work with a large Christian faith-based NGO in my consulting capacity. Myself, I'm a Catholic by upbringing and now a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church here in the US. And Martha and I coincidentally met several times at an Interaction CEO retreat and a Women's CEO retreat. Interaction is the umbrella organization for NGOs here in the US. So Martha, with that long intro, welcome.
Thank you, Tosca. And I'm just delighted to join you on this podcast. In fact, the name of it just intrigues me, the fact that it's about NGO soul and strategy. That had me hooked from the very beginning.
Oh, that's lovely to know. Well, soul, what I meant it to convey is not so much the spiritual soul of NGOs, although that can definitely be an important asset. What I meant is I have a particular preoccupation with organizational culture and identity and DNA of NGOs as organization. And the soul to me is also related to that. So
true. It has so many meanings, right?
I love that. But I love that you were attracted to that. I like it too. So Martha, let's start. No, actually, first I have to tell our audience a little bit about you. So you're the president and CEO of Medical Teams International, which is based in Portland, Oregon, here in the US. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Still the case. Yes. You worked for 19 years at World Vision, where you were a vice president, a senior director, the head of the Africa region's HIV AIDS division, a national director, and and more number of capacities in World Vision before you came to Medical Teams International, and you have a degree in public health from Johns Hopkins University. So, Martha, for those who do not know Medical Teams International, what is your mission all about, and what makes you stand out from other NGOs who, I imagine, deliver a medical services? What is your organization's unique added value?
Thanks, Tesca. So Medical Teams International, we, as you already mentioned, were headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and we were started in 1979 by a Salem businessman responding to the plight of the Cambodian refugees. So we are a Christian health and humanitarian organization. And in fact, when I started with the organization in 2016, we sort of went back to what do we do best and really focus the strategy even more on the health and humanitarian space, because we're a small or medium-sized nonprofit. And so we really wanted to bring our best to the world of humanitarian response. And that means providing basic, as we like to say, life-saving medical care. So we do primary care and run health facilities. And we also seek to strengthen and work alongside the Ministry of Health and the medical actors in any particular context, and work with the community. So strengthening, you know, those who have been impacted either by natural disasters or from man-made crises. And of course, we're seeing more of the latter in terms of the complexity of the conflicts that we're responding to, whether it's the civil war in Ethiopia or the war in Ukraine, where we're responding today. So we are active in seven countries, and then the US as well. So eight total is where we're working at the moment.
Got it. But it's always in a crisis, whether man-made or nature-made. So it's most often shorter-term relief of a medical nature.
That's a great question. So actually, because one of the myths, you said you like to explore myths. One of the myths is that refugees are in a country in a short-term basis, which is not true.
They're not.
I mean, the average amount of time that they spend is anywhere from 12 to 20 years. So in fact, we do have long-term programs, but the long-term programs that we run are with the refugee or displaced population. So our biggest program, for example, is in Uganda, where we are providing health services, again, in partnership with the Ministry of Health for 1.3 million people. So about 65 different clinics, and that includes the refugees as well as the surrounding community. So there's some long-term programs with refugees in Tanzania, in Uganda. We're responding to the Venezuelans that have fled into Colombia, also the Ethiopians that have fled into Sudan. So running programs in Sudan and Ethiopia, and then in Moldova and Ukraine.
Got it. Now, you mentioned, and this was something that was immediately of interest to me when I researched Medical Teams, is that you have a U.S. domestic program as well. Why did you start that? And what does it do for you? By which I mean, as an organization, from a reputational perspective here in the U.S. with domestic constituencies, I could imagine it could be meaningful for them in terms of deepening local ownership. What does it do for you from a fundraising perspective? Why did you do it?
Great question. And in fact, the domestic side of our program has existed for 33 years. So this decision far preceded my arrival to Medical Teams. And initially, the thought was, you know, we are in the business of helping people access care when they're in a very critical point where they really have no access. And of course, that applies to our neighbors in the U.S. So there are many populations in the U.S. that for various reasons don't have access to care. So initially, I think they started in medical with a medical van, and then it switched for a long time to exclusively dental. So our big recreational vehicles, you know, with medical teams on the side, we're providing mobile dental services.
Right.
That's because many people in the U.S. had no access to dental care.
Absolutely.
And that is obviously a significant impact for their health. I mean, we tend to disassociate dental from health, but it is intricately related.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally. And I have to tell for a moment, Martha, spontaneously, as a European who's lived in the US now 20 years, and I live in upstate New York, in the rural part of upstate New York, especially in my first 5 to 10 years, I was struck by how many people who are low income clearly have not had dental care for a long time. So
that's
I think it's wonderful now that you focus on dental care. So, but do you feel, I'm curious, do you feel that having a domestic program of a significant size, not an add-on, if you will, is that helping you with the local, having local roots here in the US, not just from a donor perspective, more broadly, local ownership?
Yes. And let me back up just a teeny bit to say what has changed from it being mobile dental for a long time, but then that will help me get to answering that question specifically, which is when we switched our strategy in May of 2017 and really decided to focus on the humanitarian context overseas, we also made a strategic decision to align our US program more systematically with what we were doing overseas. So we started to think about, if we're getting to people who don't have access to dental care, what else do they need? How else could we participate in the social safety net in terms of helping them to connect to other sources of care? Because many of them have multiple needs, whether it's housing or whether they don't actually also have access to health, whether they're suffering from the impact of mental health and addictions and need access to those services. So we started to think about how our program could become a more complete package of services and be part of the social safety net in the US. Mm. And so we said we wanted to pilot what we were starting to call Care and Connect. How can we provide that immediate, urgent care that they need and connect them into long-term care, whatever that might be? And then COVID hit. And so with COVID, we hadn't even had a chance to pilot this idea of Care and Connect, but immediately the health departments in Oregon and Washington reached out to us because we had these mobile vehicles and a way to get out to populations that didn't have access, whether they didn't speak English, BIPOC communities, elderly, veterans, houseless. You know, these were all people that urgently needed COVID services. So in the midst of responding to COVID, we grew exponentially and really started to partner very closely with our departments of health in these two states and major health systems. And so that has helped us to literally triple the size of our program in the last 2.5 years, starting with COVID vaccination, well, starting with COVID testing, and then moving into vaccinations, and then coming full circle with a Biden administration innovation grant to add the dental care back in, which was exactly what we wanted to do in the first place, you know, move towards a Care and Connect model. So that's where we stand today. And back to your question, we do love the fact that this allows us to talk about the needs of Americans and how urgent care for us is incredibly important, and that we want to serve our neighbors, whether they're here in the States and don't access care, or whether they're refugees and displaced overseas and have no access to care. So it provides a consistent message for us and a local base.
And a local mentioned. To global, also living out basically what local to global means. And
that
issues of poverty and discrimination and injustice, et cetera, are just as much here relevant here in the US as they are elsewhere, which I increasingly is an incredibly important message to act on. Now, switching to you as an individual leader, tell us a little bit about moments from your childhood that shaped you to be the person you are today. Before we started recording, you told me a snippet of a remarkable story. Do you want to go back there?
Sure. Thanks, Tesca. I think what a key motivational story for me is really the impact that my dad had on my life. And so he was a medical doctor. I was an army brat who remarkably hated moving and then have spent the rest of my life moving around the world. But the reason that he had such an impact on me is that he, first of all, loved his patients. So he loved medicine. So I grew up, spending a lot of time in hospitals. He was an obstetrician and gynecologist and didn't want to be a pediatrician because he hated, he was just so moved by the sick children. So he wanted to be on the happy end of helping kids, come into being. That's right. So surrounded by those medical sort of roots, I then had an opportunity when I was 12, I was running with my dad. And really tragically, he had a sudden heart attack and passed away.
I see.
Immediately. Yeah. So that, as you can imagine, as a young teenager, obviously shook my world to its core. And I was a pretty happy-go-lucky kid up to that point. But I think after experiencing that, I really wanted to lean into his legacy and decided that I would follow in his footsteps and become a doctor. And because of my church community, I thought, well, I want to be a missionary doctor because the people overseas, even though I had never traveled overseas, I thought they really need care even more than Americans do. So headed out with that intention and then got to college and into the pre-med program and kind of had my second sort of most pivotal moment, which got me into public health. And that was really starting to most pre-med students get to organic chemistry. And what they don't tell you is that 50% of the students drop out at that point, right?
So yes, my kids have experience with that.
So you know that from a personal perspective. So got to organic, I was playing field hockey, involved in a tutoring program in Southside Chicago, working, and just got so overloaded and thought, why am I doing this? I'm going to have so much debt. I'm not going to be able to go overseas until I'm 35. So I had a real crisis as only a, 20 something year old can have a crisis that was going to end my life, of course, and decided to give it all up. And then ran into some students that were part of a program called Human Needs and Global Resources at Wheaton College. And they told me that they were headed to Cameroon to do public health. And I was like, public health? I had never even heard of public health. So signed up immediately and was able to join that program and really study anthropology. It was kind of like a minor program. And then that sent me to Cameroon for 6 months to work with there were some Baptist missionaries that were running a community healthcare program in very, very remote villages. And that allowed me to live in those remote villages and work with community health workers for 6 months. And that experience cemented my love for public health.
And for community health.
Yes.
Got it.
That's right.
Now, we all have experienced failures in our lives. And some of the mistakes that actually help us shape in useful ways, right? Tell me about one or two of those that you think made you the leader that you are today.
Oh, there's all of us have a long litany of failures, right? But which ones are most instructive? I think for me, I probably experienced the most leadership failures in my biggest stint as a new leader when I moved from being the health director in Mozambique. So I was the health director for World Vision Mozambique. And then they asked me to take on the country director role. And I really had very little training. So 33-year-old public health person being asked to take on a big country director role for a large program. Mm. It's about 28 million, 900 staff, 5 provinces. So it was like jumping into the deep end. So nothing like a primer to learn your leadership skills really fast. And I think one of the first things I realized is that I had all these ideas of how this program should change because it had really emerged out of responding to the civil war in Mozambique. And so now the transition had happened and Mozambique was, reestablishing itself as a young democracy. So of course the program needed to change and modify. So I think I embarked on all that change really on my own and didn't understand, you know, a lot of the general concepts about organizational change that, you know.
Oh, which I love.
Yes, of course, as an organizational change person, right? You need leaders, you know, Cotter's leading change. You need that guiding coalition. So I think at first I just thought I was just going to barrel into this program of change without really bringing people with me. And so I think I learned a very powerful lesson that you cannot affect that change as a leader alone. You know, you need to bring people with you. You need to take time to build the reason why you're changing. And I think having had that experience in Mozambique, when I came to medical teams and we really embarked on significant change in terms of refocusing the organization on the humanitarian context, that allowed me to do it in a better way the second time around.
Oh, this makes me think, Martha, that I should interview you on a separate occasion about that case study.
Sure.
Talk about that case study in change management and what you think you did right, what you think you did wrong, and what you learned. But that's for another day.
Sure.
So let's move to the topic of faith-based organizations, right? In my view, they have huge assets in the form of staff and board members, volunteers, etc. Often have a deep well of motivation, right?
That's right.
And also, as we know, many people around the world are deeply spiritual. If they're not explicitly religious, they are definitely spiritual.
Absolutely.
And not all of them, obviously, Christian by far, but many, many people are deeply spiritual. And yet it seems that secular NGOs and also the kind of development discipline seems to often assume that is not the case, and that we look at the world purely from a secular perspective, which then doesn't always work, right, in our program intentions, etc., in short. On top of that, faith-based organizations have potentially a deep well of trust in local communities through the churches, the mosques, the temples, etc., right?
That's right.
So I'm curious, to what extent does medical teams benefit from the natural bonding and trust that can exist between different people of the same faith? Do these assets that I just listed, do they play out for medical teams or not so much?
Yes, they do. And maybe let me perhaps explain a little bit about medical teams.
Please do. You told me something interesting.
That's right. And how we show up as a faith-based organization is a little different than some others. And so people might have assumptions about what that means.
Yeah, please go there.
So for us, I mean, one of the operating principles is that our faith motivates us. So we are actually registered as a regular 501c3 in the US and not as a explicit faith-based nonprofit. And that has been the case for medical teams since its inception, which is interesting, but it has always been motivated by faith. And so we say that it's part of our culture and it's what inspires and motivates us. And so the calling, which we say our vision is our calling, and it's daring to love like Jesus, we boldly break barriers to health and restore wholeness in a hurting world. So that is an incredible galvanizing force for us. And we ask our staff that join medical teams how they align with that. So they don't have to, you know, necessarily ascribe to a certain denomination or have a faith statement, but what does that mean to them? How does that motivate them? And then it also shows up in our values of being courageous and tenacious, accountable, selfless, and not alone. And we say God is with us, you know, and this, and the work that we do is really hard. And so I think some of the, what you were talking about in terms of the trust and the motivation is really, it does bond us together in a sense, right? It gives us that added inspiration when things are really tough and when you're working in really difficult circumstances. We So that allows us to kind of own this middle space. And so we say that we want to attract people to join us and be part of us, whether they're staff or volunteers, or the, you know, the community volunteers that we work with, the community health volunteers that we work with overseas, because we want to be the hands and feet of Jesus and aspire to show up that way. So I love the fact that we want to lead by example, but invite, be a big tent in terms of who can join us and be part of us, whether they're from a Muslim faith or whether they're from a Christian faith, or whether they don't actually have a sense of personal faith, but they're attracted to our calling statement and our values because of who we are and how we're trying to show up.
I see. Let me probe a little bit on one point. You said that your staff are not selected or hired based on ascribing to one same church or even official religion, right? Right. Is that true all the way to the top? So is it also true that there is not a selection criteria at the higher levels of leadership? Because I know for a fact that that is true with certain other faith-based organizations, that once you are, let's say, a national director and up, as an example, right, you need to be of the same faith. How is that in medical teams?
I would say we ask the same questions about our calling statement and values to everybody at all levels. Where it is different is with our board. And that's because our board of directors are volunteers. And so historically, we have had a faith statement that the board of directors has signed. In fact, we just recently changed that to the Nicene Creed, again, because we wanted it to be broader. So you're from a Catholic background, and not now, but originally. And so the Nicene Creed for the Catholics on our board was more well understood and acceptable language. And whereas our old statement probably had more of a Protestant sounding roots to it. And so the where it gets more explicit is at the board level. And that's, again, to retain the culture of the organization and also to, you know, follow the legal requirements of a 501c3. So that allows us to exist in that space and follow those legal.
Got it. Interesting. Thank you for providing that nuance. We already talked about some of the obvious strengths that faith-based organizations have that, in my view, secular organizations sometimes, quote unquote, would die for, right? Have reason to covet. What potential weaknesses or blind spots do you see show up in medical teams or in peer organizations that you think have some link to being faith-based in whatever way each organization is differently faith-based?
Yes. I think one of the downsides oftentimes when you have people that are very passionate and motivated by their faith is I think there can be an isolation in that vision and mission is enough, right? And so there can be a naivete, perhaps, as you get into this work, especially, of not connecting with others, not understanding the humanitarian community, the professional standards that are required, you know, to work in this space, and that we really owe the people that we serve.
Yeah.
And that we, you know, we're coming alongside them, but we want to bring the best of what we have to offer. And so that means connecting into that humanitarian community. So you sometimes see younger or smaller faith-based organizations kind of barreling in as if they are completely able to manage this context on their own, right? And I think that can be a real weakness. They may not show up to be part of the humanitarian cluster. And so we are always encouraging smaller Christian organizations to coordinate, to be part of the broader secular and faith-based community of practice, so to speak, and to coordinate and learn together. So we're part of a group called the Integral Alliance, which is 21 Christian development and humanitarian organizations that do just that. They try and partner together. And many of them are smaller. And so by being part of this alliance, we have made a choice to respond to disasters together. And with that, that has allowed us to help some of these smaller Christian nonprofits to understand, hey, we believe that the core humanitarian standards are absolutely essential and now have adopted those and are as an alliance ascribing to those standards. Another weakness can be sometimes in a humanitarian response, if your only partner is the church. That's not true of medical teams, because we see our partner as the Ministry of Health and the humanitarian partners that we work alongside. But we have seen some Christian nonprofits that work through the church. If you bring that to a humanitarian response, that can be a little tricky in the speed of that response. Those partners may not understand the core humanitarian principles, for example, and how to avoid proselytism. And so there's a need to really help your partners to understand all of those principles that are so important, that we do not offer any aid that is tied to any belief or any participation in a religious activity that is proselytism. So some of those key principles
need to be
reinforced.
That sounds marvelous to me. I'm really happy to hear you unpack in such a nuanced, thoughtful ways what are both the strengths and the weaknesses. I totally resonate with everything you just said. Now, one particular aspect that actually your team suggested we also address in this podcast, and I'm definitely interested in that angle too, is about what's it like to be a woman top leader in a faith-based organization like medical teams. Anecdotally, I'm saying that really underlined, anecdotally, it seems that women are underrepresented in Christian faith-based organizations in, let's say, the top two levels of leadership. I haven't done the research on this, but that's my sense. Would you comment on that? Do you think there is some truth in that or not? And how does it play out for you as a top leader?
Great question, Tesca. And I think your assumption is, from what we have seen in the U.S. space, the Christian humanitarian or the Christian development nonprofits are behind the secular nonprofits in the U.S. And so we talked earlier about how we met through Interaction. And,
yes.
And I think those, I heard the story, and you probably have too, at one point Interaction had predominantly male CEOs. And then over time, that has changed really dramatically, right? It's almost 50-50 right now, as far as I know.
Oh, yeah.
And in the Christian nonprofit space, it is not 50%, not in the U.S. Now, that Integral Alliance that I talked about, when I started, I think there was one or two couple women CEOs, and we've seen bit by bit it changing, but it's slower, and it's slower in the U.S. as well. And I wonder if that is because of the teaching in the church. And so many churches in the U.S. are grappling in terms of their understanding of what does the Bible say about women in leadership. And I think that unconsciously may impact the culture of these Christian nonprofits. They would say, no, you know, women have equal opportunity in our nonprofit. But I think that perhaps some of their own personal beliefs may provide some of that unconscious bias that may hold women back a bit from rising in the ranks. And in fact, a brief little story of an aspiring young woman that I know is—I tell her all the time she's going to be the next president of the United States. So she is, you know, top notch, and she was a fellow in a Christian university, and then was asked to be mentored by the president. But then she found that the president was uncomfortable with having her travel with him, but her male counterpart, there was no discomfort there. So just small ways that Christian women may have a disadvantage that's not even explicit, really, although she she saw it as explicit and did something about it as a young advocate. So, but I think those are the kinds of barriers that Christian women may experience in their careers that can make it a little difficult to crash into the upper levels of leadership in some organizations, not all.
No, definitely not. But it is somewhat noticeable, as you said. So you've already talked deep about these kind of archetypes or belief systems about women and positional power, right? And there are others that secular organizations may well also struggle with. But
sure.
It sounds like you do think that the archetypes about women and positional power and organizational leadership, et cetera, are somewhat different from those of secular NGOs. Is that the case?
Yes, I think so. Because if on Sundays you worship at a church where women are not allowed to be elders or pastors or preachers, mm-hmm. I think that subtly influences you. So you use the word archetype. So maybe that starts to bring some of the internal conflict, right? That, well, why in this house of worship are women not allowed to be leaders, but now they can be leaders in a Christian nonprofit? That creates some yeah. dissonance, right? In terms yeah. of those beliefs, perhaps making it a little bit harder to see women as legitimate leaders in a different context. So if you don't see them yeah. as leaders in one context, how do you then flip the switch to say, oh, but they can be leaders in every other part of society? I think that creates some internal conflict for people, certainly yeah. for me. And I'm part of a book club of women who have been studying these issues and reading books and going back to like even what their original text in the Bible said, and how some of that bias might even be implicit in the ways that words have been translated.
Oh yeah.
Over the centuries.
Goes back. You make me think, Martha, of my time during my when I was studying my master's degree and my interest in feminist theology from a right. Catholic perspective at that time.
Sure.
It's the same thing, right? These things go very deep. But at the same time, I hear you say they are shifting. And it sounds like the Integral Alliance is, as part of a probably much bigger mission, but is aware of this as an issue and is trying to make a difference in that regard?
To some extent, although each organization has its own board and comes from countries around the world, it's international, right? So we have the whole Tier Fund group that represents, you know, from Tier Fund New Zealand to Tier Fund Canada. So to some degree, having these conversations with respect to diversity, equity, and inclusion, especially the inclusion piece, right, in terms of inequity for both men and women. And so it's part of those conversations, but each organization, I think, has to go on a journey, on its own journey, right, if you're going to have a CEO
yeah.
That rises up and is asked by the board, you know, to invited by the board to come on as CEO. And so for me, there was a very influential woman that was part of the board of medical teams that played that role of opening up the conversation to say, oh, when they started meeting with the recruiter to say, oh, well, she might be this, this, and this. And it could be a woman that would be the right candidate. And very skillfully and influentially, a leader herself created space within the board for that to be discussed and for them ultimately to say, hey, we want you, Martha. Will you come on as president and CEO? So you see that each institution has to go on its own journey. So while the Integral yeah. Alliance can talk about it, we don't have much contact with the board. And the board is the ones that recruit the CEO. So I see that change needing to happen within board of directors.
I see.
Ultimately.
And we know, of course, that there are also huge differences within each institutionalized religion, right?
That's right.
Geographically, et cetera, across the world, in social values around women and around LGBT people, et cetera, et cetera. So it's no religious institution is a homogeneous body in that regard.
That's right.
I need to ask you one more thing before we need to bring this to a close, and that is shifting topic again, mm-hmm. and that is about medical teams messaging. I was struck when I looked at your website, you emphasize words like loving the vulnerable, healing suffering, healing the broken, saving, this idea of saving people. Right. And I come across that and also in some secular organizations for sure. Mm-hmm. But I come across that more, it seems, even in, amongst faith-based organizations. And as you know, because I know you're very well tapped into the current kind of discussions in the NGO sector, that in some part of our community, there's a lot of discussion and self-interrogation on decolonizing aid, shifting power, anti-racism, diversity, equity, and inclusion. From that perspective, do you think that the language that medical teams uses, is there anything that makes you as a top leader wonder whether that language needs to undergo some change of its own or not necessarily?
Yeah, are you comfortable? Very astute. I'm glad that you have been perusing our website and asking those questions, because you're right, Tuska. This conversation, we're on a journey as an organization in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and decolonization of aid, like many of our peer organizations. Mm-hmm. So we really have been digging into the diversity, equity, inclusion space more, especially with everything that happened in the US around George Floyd, and really thinking about it from a US context first. But this year we have prioritized really digging into the decolonization of aid and doing some more learning there. So I would say we have moved away, and maybe we need to do another scrub of our website with saying that people are vulnerable. So you're right. If that's still showing up, we want to make that change, because they are survivors. They're not victims. They're heroes in their own right in terms of their ability to survive and thrive in incredibly difficult circumstances. So we are working to shift that. And there may be some vestiges that still need to change. I think the saving piece is interesting, because we have used that very explicitly to help non-medical people understand that the care that we are offering is truly life-saving.
We always say it's life-saving.
And so I'm a little distressed to think that, you know, folks would think, oh, it's this, we're saving the world. No, that we, and that white savior complex, we do not want that to be misunderstood, but we've been trying to kind of take medical language and make it very accessible to say that the care that we provide is truly life-saving. So a story, we in Tigray, you know, as the embargo, Tigray has been embargoed until very recently for a year and a half. Our Tigrayan staff, 90% of our staff are nationals in the context where we work. And they have continued to provide mobile medical services in Tigray with almost nothing. The only thing we could bring in was cash. And so these mobile medical teams ended up delivering babies. They're not supposed to deliver babies. The reason they delivered babies was truly life-saving. Yeah. Those women would have died.
Yeah.
So that's what we mean by life-saving. Yeah. Recently, they weren't even able to get fuel. Cars were not allowed to get out because the embargo still is not fully lifted. They hired donkeys and donkey carts to get out to provide life-saving care. So we want that idea of life-saving to mean, hey, we're there in the most critical moment. We want to be there with people when they truly don't have access to medical care, and step into that gap, but then eventually hand over to the Ministry of Health and leave. You know, our dream is to exit, you know, to be there with people in crisis, serving with nationals who speak their language, who have incredible skills and experience, and then, you know, eventually be able to hand over and exit, having really reestablished those facilities and allowing the Ministry of Health to continue to provide those services.
I'm so glad I asked you the question, and that makes a lot of sense.
That's right.
So I'm glad we dug in there a little bit. Well, we have to bring this to a close, Martha. So
this sad.
This was very, very interesting to me. Where can people go if they want to learn more about you as a person, as a leader, sure, and medical teams as an organization?
Well, Chris, I can go to our Medical Teams International website, which is medicalteams.com. And then I am very active on LinkedIn, so they can just look up Martha Holley, H-O-L-L-E-Y Newsom, and find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter. I'm trying to remember my handle.
We can put that in the show notes. Don't worry.
Thank you. If you help me with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the platforms, people can easily find me on
good.
Twitter,
and you also
Instagram.
Mentioned in addition before we started recording that there was a 30-minute radio story produced about your life, right?
And that's right. Our American Stories. And we will provide that link for your listeners.
Would. Yeah, I would love to include that in the show notes, because based on what you told me just in that small snippet, that probably is very worthy of listening by myself and anybody else who wants to. Thank you very much, Martha, for all your insights. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast stimulating, then be sure to check out other episodes of my podcast. There is, for instance, episode 25 that celebrates the presence of three women leaders, three Latina women at the helm of major NGOs. And you can find that episode and others not just on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, but also on my YouTube channel. Subscribe to my email list and you'll be the first to know next time when I interview super interesting people like Martha. This is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time on NGO Soul and Strategy. Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@fiveoaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.